Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet John Rocco and learn why he feels all picture book authors and illustrators have a responsibility to create a promise for their readers. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 385 of the podcast with John Rocco. John's newest book is with author Sherry Dusky Rinker of Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site. And it's entitled Big Machines, the story of Virginia Lee Burton. Chances are you've grown up hearing and loving Ginny's stories since you were very, very young. The Little House, Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel, Katie and the Big Snow. Ginny was showing her boys something special as she created these long-beloved characters. My conversation with John touches both on the care and love that John brought to the illustrations in this story, and also the amazing work Ginny was doing through her stories. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here is episode number 385 of the podcast with John Rocco. Welcome to the podcast, John Rocco, at long last. I'm glad we're talking on record.
Finally.
Yeah, no doubt. You have names on books in my library that get checked out all the time. And I was just saying before recording, I'm going to a new library and starting a new collection, and I'll welcome you there as well. So thank you just for being, you know, a presence in my library life.
Well, thank you for having me on your shelves. It's always a thrill to hear your books are out there in the world. You know, John, when you're just sitting in your studio, you think they're just on my shelf.
John, how many years have you been putting books on library shelves like this?
My first book that I wrote and illustrated came out in 2007.
Yeah.
So about 10 years.
Yeah.
And before that, I did one children's book out of college. And then I sort of went into art direction, entertainment for a long time. And then I decided in 2005, around there, that I would quit doing all of that and just focus on making books.
Come back into making books. Did you go to school?
Yeah. The first book I made, I would say I didn't really know what I was doing. I was a
fair.
I went to a school design for a couple of years after living with an illustrator, who, you know, he would sit in his room and make pictures and get paid for it. And I thought, this is fantastic. So I transferred out of engineering school and went to Rhode Island School of Design, studied there for a couple of years, and then went to School of Visual Arts in New York City. And while I was there, I was a bartender to make money and to help pay for school. And in the process, and I've told this story many times, but I'll tell you the abbreviated version, which is I was bartending for the after party for the Tony Awards, and I met Whoopi Goldberg. And behind the bar, I always kept a sample of my work, and which I gave to her that night. And she called me up and said, let's do a children's book together.
What?
So about 3 days before I graduated college, I had a contract to do a picture book with Whoopi Goldberg.
Whoopi Goldberg, oh my gosh. Yeah.
And it was, I mean, it was a crazy night. The whole night was nuts. The night I was bartending, because the first thing I did was served a glass of wine to Audrey Hepburn.
Whoa.
That was quite a treat. So I did that book, and it was called Alice. And it got reviewed really positively, at least the art did, in the New York Times. So that was fun.
Well, that's a win.
The best quote was John Rocco's vision of New York is akin to Edward Hopper on mind-altering drugs.
Wow. That is not a quote you soon forget. Goodness.
No. So that was in 1992. And then I switched gears, moved out to California, and worked in the entertainment field designing everything from television to video games to movies to theme parks. I worked as an Imagineer at Disney for a while. I worked at DreamWorks and a bunch of other places, and really learned a lot. But the one thing that I always came back to was that everything I was designing and everything I was drawing was a way of storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was a ride or a museum, or you're always trying to tell a story, even a commercial, which is basically a 30-second story. And so then I just felt like I, you know, wanted to get back into kids' books, and I always collected them, and it was a real passion of mine. I was lucky enough to get a contract to illustrate originally what was going to be a version of The Boy Who Cried Wolf, but I decided I wanted to write my own version, and so I sort of wrote a fractured fable version of it called Wolf Wolf.
Yes.
And that was the first book that came out, and now I don't know how many books I've done since then.
So you're a couple books deep since then, yeah?
Yeah, about 20, maybe. Both middle grade and the picture books.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you've got some art on Percy Jackson of all things. That book did kind of well. I mean, that probably helped a little, right?
Oh yeah, that's
sold
been
a couple copies.
That's been a lot of fun. We've been doing those for 10 years now.
Yes, right?
And the Lightning Thief cover was actually the first book jacket I ever illustrated.
Oh, cool. Well, how does one get approached to do a book jacket? Just from they know your, I mean, the art director knows your work from picture books and asks if you'd, you know, try it?
Well, in this particular case, the first Percy Jackson book, The Lightning Thief, was originally published by Miramax. And,
oh, yeah, because it has that weird, like, comic-y cover. I can picture it.
Miramax was like Weinstein Books. They were bought by Weinstein Books or something like that. Anyway, so I was just about to come out with my first book, Wolf Wolf, and I was going to the Book Expo. And I thought, who do I know in publishing? I don't know anybody in publishing. I've been working in entertainment. And I thought to myself, okay, there's one guy I know, and he was the editor for the book Alice. And his name is Rob Weisbach. And I looked him up, and I found out, hey, he's at Weinstein Books, yeah. Miramax. And he's the vice president of Weinstein Books. So I'm going to go to their booth at BEA and see if I can run into him. Sure enough, I run into him. I hadn't seen him in 14 years, and it was like yesterday.
Wow. He was like, just John! At the booth. The vice president of the publishing company is just at the booth, like you do.
He was just at the booth, I went up to him. I said, "Rob," and he hadn't changed at all. He looked exactly the same. And so I said, "Yeah, I'm getting back into publishing." He goes, "Let me stop you right there. I've got the perfect project. Can you do book jackets?"
And I said, booth, oh. John, he's offering you a thing at the booth. That's amazing. Oh my word.
Well, so I said, "Yeah, of course I can do book jackets."
Yeah.
So he sent me in to meet the editor, who was Jen Besser. And, I read the manuscript and did a little sketch in her office. And she said, "Yeah, that's great. Go with that," because they wanted to repackage the book. And so I did the illustration, and it sort of snowballed from there. Then they signed me up to do books 2 and 3, and then 4 and 5, and then the next series, and the next series, and the next series. So
if I can just stop and compliment you, the cover you made is like iconic in children's literature now. That wonderful illustration of Percy holding the pen sword while he's standing in the water, like right before he faces Hades. It's such a great scene to pull from in that book.
Thanks. Well, it's not actually a scene in the book. And that was kind of what I was going for. I think part of it was that I hadn't even looked at middle grade book jackets when I did this book jacket. I was just trying to extrapolate, what is the story about? And I felt like it wasn't really about mythology. And it was about a kid stuck in the middle of two adults in an argument.
Yes.
Right? And those two adults happen to be Zeus and Poseidon. And so I figured, let's put him all alone in the water, stormy sky representing Zeus, you know, Poseidon with the raging ocean at his feet. And I wanted to have him sort of like walking into the book, because I always feel like as a reader, when you see a very detailed illustration of one of the characters on the cover, you can't project yourself onto that character very easily. Hmm. So I always try to not do that, if that makes sense. And I also like the idea of following this character into the book. So a lot of times, especially on a lot of the Percy covers, you'll kind of see the characters from behind, like walking into the adventure. So anyway, they re-released the book, and it sold like wildfire, and the whole thing caught on really well. And I was always amazed, you know, as I'm doing more and more for the series. I remember I think we were on the Heroes of Olympus series.
Yeah.
And I get an email from the editor, at the time was, Stephanie Lurie. And she said, "Yes, we're doing a first printing of like 5 million copies or something."
Whoa.
And I suddenly, it just like my knees went to jello, because I remember, no pressure, right? I remember,
but this is coming from the guy who handed his art to Whoopi Goldberg in a bar. So,
yeah, but it was like, exactly. And going back to that, those samples, like the sample I gave her cost me about $7 to make, because first of all, I didn't have a computer at the time. So I had to have my artwork professionally photographed, and then I mounted it on paper and did this whole thing. And so for me to make like 40 mailers to send out costs like $100.
Mm. Mm.
And so suddenly the idea of one of my paintings on millions of copies of books out there in the world sort of blew my mind. And it still does.
I can imagine.
I have to put it out of my head a little bit when I'm working on the painting.
I was just going to say that, to approach anything and know how well viewed that art will be, it would be something I have to get out of my head. And I love, by the way, just to go back to the cover of Lightning Thief, that you've made a cover designed so evocatively that we readers can just project ourselves into the story and see what we want to see in it. I feel like I'm a walking testament to exactly what just happened on that. But that is cool that not only are you approaching the art that way, but I also like how it reflects that notion of a book being a window into a world. And you're creating that in the jacket itself, that we can look into the story and then keep looking into the story as we read that, as we read it.
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of approached it as that as an illustrator of a book, you have the responsibility to actually create a promise to the reader. Meaning, if you like this illustration enough to pick up the book, I promise you what's inside, it's going to be good.
Oh, I like that.
You know what I mean? Like, and so I've never been the type to say, oh, let's find a scene in the book and just illustrate that. I'm always trying to figure out a way to sort of distill, what is this book about? You know, for instance, I'm just looking at my bookshelf now, like, for instance, Son of Neptune. That is the second book in the Heroes of Olympus series. And when the Heroes of Olympus series came out, suddenly the first book did not have Percy Jackson in it.
Right.
And so the fans were kind of like, what's going on? We're freaking out.
This is not what you promised to deliver.
Well, I think they were like waiting. And yeah. So Son of Neptune suddenly, because Neptune is the Roman version of Poseidon, the fans knew just from the name of the title, mm-hmm. Percy's back. And so I wanted to give them that on the cover. You know, this has got to be Percy as a hero. So there's the image of him, you know, sort of exploding out of the icy water in Alaska is what became the cover.
Yeah.
And again, there's the last book in the series, or the second to last book in the series, The House of Hades. That's the, you know, what the fans call the Persebeth cover, which is Percy and Annabeth are on the cover.
Yeah.
It's for her first time on a cover.
I love that the fans, so, of course they do, but I love that the fans have a name for it. I knew exactly what you were talking about as soon as you said it, but that's hilarious.
There's always a lot of chatter when one of his new covers comes out because they're trying to decipher, you know, what's going to happen in the book.
Yeah.
Based
they're
on
studying
the
your art. Wow. What great.
Yeah.
What a great testament also to art that we see on children's books, that we talk all the time about picture books being these like handheld museums into art that are meant to be studied, and to know that your covers are having that exact same effect, that these kids are studying that and interpreting it. It's no different than what you would do in a portrait gallery. It's no different than anything like that at all. And yet,
right.
And yet that's exactly how they're behaving. That's great.
Yeah, it's really fun. I think it happens more often with the, you know, the middle grade readers that they make more of a connection to the artist who actually created the art. I had started a group in Brooklyn when I was there called the Bookmakers Dozen, and our objective was to try to get artwork in the hands of kids. So we would put together these shows, and I would make prints of there was 13 of us in the group, and I would make prints of their work that we would frame and sell. And so I got these, you know, inexpensive wooden frames that looked really nice, like museum-like frames and with plexiglass. And we would sell, so you could buy the book and the print for $100, and it would be signed by the artist, and they would actually be there to meet the artist. And it was really fun. It was me and Peter Brown, Sophie Blackall, Brian Floca, Dan Yaccarino, Sean Qualls, Brett Hellquist. I'm trying to remember who else.
We had a
bunch. Yeah. Johnny Marciano was part of that, and Sergio. So yeah. Yeah,
well, friend.
So we had a studio together, Sergio and Brian and Sophie and John.
Oh, you're part of that studio.
Yeah.
There's a connection I wasn't putting together yet. I forgot about that.
Well, I had left,
sadly,
to move back to L.A., but what happened was Brian and I, well, I was looking for a new space, and I had emailed Brian because we've been having coffee a lot and talking about books, and he said he might be interested in a new space, and then I found a place, and then he said, you know, Sophie's kind of looking for a new space too, and then Johnny chimed in and said, yeah, I'm kind of looking for a space. And then Sergio just said, I'm not doing anything today. I'll walk over there with you guys. So we kind of turned it into a little outing, and we went to this space, and it was just a perfect studio. And it was very reasonable. It was over in Gowanus, which is, you know, part of sort of near Red Hook area. And we decided, yeah, let's do this. And so we had this little studio where we would all work on our books and all go to lunch together. And it was really idyllic. You know, I didn't realize how special it was until after I left. And I was like, duh, I miss it.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I want to go back to this thing you said, the sentiment about the responsibility to create a promise. And to withhold that promise and to pay out on that promise. Because here we are, we've gone this whole time talking, and I neglected to bring up your new picture book that you have with Sherry Dusky Rinker, which it has a promise on the cover that I feel like engages those younger readers. We talked about the middle grade readers. You have this promise that you're going to deliver something in this story. But I feel like when you engage younger readers, you have likewise a promise that what you show on the cover is going to be something that we get to find inside. And in this case, we have trucks and vehicles and things like that on the cover. And while these children may or may not know that this is the story of Virginia Lee Burton and who this woman is, just seeing these vehicles that hopefully are things that parents are reading to them or just that they like, and going into this story and realizing that here was this woman who poured out her heart for her boys into her stories, is something really special. And John, I got to give you praise up front, because I feel like to be an illustrator who is capturing the life and, more importantly, the work of such an iconic illustrator, such a beloved illustrator, is something that you really took great care and love in doing. And I think you executed it really well. I love specifically how much you have you've shown us Ginny and her family and such sort of vivid realism, so that the illustrations could be portrayed the way they are in her books. I feel like you balance those really well and brought a lot of love and light into this story.
Thanks. Yeah, it was an interesting project. You know, I knew of her books. I didn't know anything about her.
I knew nothing going into this, nothing at all.
And so in starting to do my research, of course, I started with Barbara's book, Barbara Ellman, I think her name is, I want to say, who wrote a great book about her life. I think it's Virginia Lee Burton, A Life in Art, or something like that. I wish I had the right title.
I'll look it up and include it in the notes.
Yeah, but so I started with that, and then I was watching some documentaries about her, and then the best part was Sherry called me and said, John, we're going to Aris's house, and Aris is the little boy on the left on the cover, her son. And he happens to live in Santa Barbara, which is about a hour and a half drive from here. And so we went up there and spent an amazing, amazing day going through box after box of sketches and journals and her linoleum cuts and all of this artwork that she had left, you know, with him. And it was incredible. It was just amazing because it was like peeking into someone's mind. As you went through the sketchbooks, you could kind of see how she developed these ideas. And so it gave me a lot of insight into her process for design. And I think with any, I think, you know, any good picture book illustrator goes through all these things, but they have their own methods and their own process. And there's a lot of thought, you know, when you see a good book, it's good for a reason because people put a lot of thought into the design of the book. The colors they use, the style, the where the type goes, where we're going to have negative space, where we're going to let the book breathe a little bit, where we're going to have that little cliffhanger, you know. So all of these things are thought out, and she was a master of it. And I had a whole new appreciation of her work. So I kind of dove into just studying how she did these things. And then with Sherry's manuscript, which was so fun because she wrote it knowing that the illustrator was going to explain some things, you know, which is a great way to do it. I think a lot of people, when they write a manuscript and they're not illustrators, they'll tend to describe too much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you write and illustrate a picture book, the way I do sometimes my own books, I'll write down a lot of stuff, but then as I illustrate it, I'll start stripping away the text.
Yes, I've heard that before, right.
Yeah, and so, for instance, you know, when Sherry wrote the line, and everyone who knows Ginny will tell you she can fly. Yes. Now, unless I knew that she was a dancer, and unless I knew that, like, every day she would go in the backyard and dance on this marble slab that they used as a dining table, you know, I wouldn't have known that's what she meant.
But she just left it for me. She just left
she
it like that.
Well, she obviously trusted that I would figure that out, which is great because then, you know, it wouldn't have been as special if it said, and everyone who knows Ginny will tell you she was an amazing dancer and could fly or whatever, you know. So it was important to figure out how am I going to say that visually to support the words. And as you know, in picture books, that's what it is. It's a dance between the words and the pictures, and they have to kind of work together to tell one story.
Yeah, one of the things I was really taken aback by in this story, as Sherry so beautifully just keeps sort of peeling back the onion to show us more and more about Ginny's life, was that I never connected for knowing these books and loving these books. And I remember Disney's animated adaptations of them. I never connected that these characters that she was creating for her boys, because her boys loved these vehicles, that they were all these female characters. She was creating strong female characters in her boys' life. I'm sure exactly like they saw in her mother. She was showing them all these things. I thought that is one of the most beautiful things, that they find strength and comfort in her, and she's showing the blending of these two things. You see this big, beautiful vehicle. Well, in a lot of ways, it shares the sameness of Ginny.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so taken back that.
Yeah, they're all well, except for Choo Choo, they all have female names.
Yeah.
Mary. Maybell and Katie.
Katie, yeah. And just that Sherry would draw that out, not just to say that, oh, her boys really loved the trains, and so she drew a book about trains. And but there's just an emphasis there on the pronoun that I thought was subtle, but just spoke about who this woman was and the way that her boys looked up to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I...
That's a nice explanation.
Again, I come back to just the way that you illustrated this too, knowing that in such a weird way, this is a book that will make kids read different books, that will make them go to a different source material. I feel like this is so... Maybe it's what I'm trying to express is that I don't think I know of very many biographies of picture book makers. And so to read a book about a picture book maker and one that was working in the 1920s and 30s, she was coming to illustration at a time when I think the world was changing for women because of the war and because of picture books becoming, coming into their own, and just timing was something that was on Ginny's side. And I think really the world was better for it, for what she showed us in what feels so intimately. I keep thinking about what feels so intimately in this story, that she's just making these books for her boys.
Right. Yeah. And also, you know, she really broke a lot of molds for work, and sort of set the stage for the books a lot of people do today. No one was doing what she was doing, you know, as far as laying out the text and the sense of design and repetition and things like that. I mean, the genius of The Little House being this static thing in the middle of the page when everything else around it is constantly changing as you turn the page. It's incredible. It blew me away.
It's a brilliant book to think, like you're saying, and in so many ways that we have a character that doesn't move, certainly doesn't move on her own volition, that it takes a truck moving her to get her to a new location, but to see the world change around you, and also in a picture book where we assume that kids like to be entertained, so that means we should make things move and jump around and be exciting, and yet you're going to make a book about a house. To imagine, that's an entire story right there, how you sell a book about a house. But you do, because you're Virginia Lee Burton, and because people know what stories you make.
Well, I think, you know, just the sense of home was so important to her.
Yeah.
I mean, she, you know, all the things that she did in the home and raising her children. And she would throw these, you know, dinner parties and costume parties. So she had this full home life with the animals she raised and also with the Folly Cove designers, which is a whole nother aspect of her art career. And if you get a chance to check out the designs that she made, it was a group of I want to say about 12 or so designers who met near her home in Folly Cove, and she was kind of the ringleader of it all. And they would make these designs, which they would print on fabric for curtains or dresses or tablecloths and placemats. And the designs are just stunning. And there's a museum in Massachusetts, in Cape May, that has all of the work of the Folly Cove designers. And there's several books on their work as well. And it's just beautiful. And that's what I was trying to emulate on the end pages.
I was just going to say on the end pages, yeah.
Yeah, sort of a sort of like, okay, if Ginny were doing a design which encapsulated all of her picture books, what might that look like? And so that you've got the gears, which are sort of like the daisies on the cover, but also representing big machines. And so it was so much fun. I got to tell you, it was so much fun to work on this book.
Well, John, I'm just going to put out there, because I have plenty of pretty crafty and ingenious friends in the children's literature community. And you have made, because of the dimensions of this book that appear to be square to me, you have made a tile pattern that can be repeated on perhaps said textiles that people might be making into things. So I I see the end papers and think, like, at first my brain went to just what it would look like to have all these books just open to the end papers and spread out, and how it would make this beautiful quilted pattern. But indeed, like you're saying, it makes a fabric, it makes a design that I think honors Jenny, and I think that's a pretty cool thing to pull off.
Well, I think she would have been mad that I didn't actually use linoleum cut to make. I think she was a perfectionist,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think she really was a perfectionist, and I, you know, I had the opportunity to look at some of her her book dummies. And in fact, I discovered the book dummy for the little house in the bottom of a cardboard box that Aris didn't even know it was there.
Whoa.
And I said, "Sherry, look at this." And we were both like kids in a candy store. But I think that she spent so much time thinking about the page and thinking about how a child would, you know, look at the pictures, but also how the words became part of the picture because they would flow into the image or replicate a pattern that is in the image. And so it made so much sense.
Yeah. And she, you know, impacted children's literature because of it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I love the way, John, that Sherry ends this book. I wanted to just share it. I kept thinking, like, what could you share from this book that, you know, would give an idea to the people listening of the story? But the way that Sherry wraps it all up in the end and captures sort of the discovery that, you know, I've heard a lot on this podcast when authors and illustrators have their book and get it in front of children, that inevitably the kids will point out something that they didn't see before.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherry ends on a note like that in the story. And I'm going to read it if you don't mind. It reads, yeah. And this is, I should say, we're telling the story of the little house being transported from the busy city out to the country. And it says, "And then just like that, the little pink house is saved by a truck. The boys jump up. That truck is the hero. A truck saved the day." Ginny smiles to herself. Well, of course they see it that way. Choo Choo and Marianne, Katie, Maybelle, and all the trucks around the little house. Big, powerful heroes, hardworking and happy, and each special and wonderful. Just like Ginny. And that's how, here in Folly Cove, Ginny's big machines and their stories come to life. Quite magically, for Aris and Michael. And for you. And so just end it with the tie-in that...
You almost put me to sleep.
Oh,
just in a good way.
To me, I my takeaway, so much so that I can't wait to tell Sherry this myself. I loved how intimate it felt as I was reading this book. Like, I was hearing this story about this woman who loved her children, who loved her boys, and wanted to bring them into her world of art, and wanted to express mm-hmm. her love for her boys. But then those two words at the end of the book, you know, remind us that we were all part of this too, that she was making them for all of us too. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful sentiment. I'm grateful, John, that you and Sherry did this together, and that it crossed under my nose, and that I got to enjoy it. And now we'll be sharing it and Ginny's work with many, many others. And also I'll be calling her Ginny in the future because I never knew that she was a Ginny to everyone in her life.
Yep.
Ginny. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. So I guess wherever I'm going in trying to express this, thank you. Thank you for bringing love to this story as well, and for helping bring light to it for all of us.
Oh, absolutely. It's completely my pleasure. I pinch myself that I get to do this, you know. I get to wake up, go to my desk, and make pictures for, you know, either my own manuscripts or someone else's, and it's such a blast. And everyone at Hode Mifflin Harcourt was amazing to work with and so supportive, and I think we all we all got caught up in this reverence, you know, for this woman. And it became so exciting. So I think that's what it was, is sort of a combination of everyone's excitement about, God, look at this woman's books and what she gave to us all. And like, you know, so this, in a way, is a love letter to her and also a reminder to people that there are these wonderful books out there that are still in print, and they're as important today as they were when they were published 60, 70, maybe now 80-something years ago.
Yes.
And so it was great to be a part of that. And
Well, you've shown your art in a way that I feel like I didn't know you before in this. And that's a beautiful thing, too, to know someone's work and then see something that just feels like it has a different voice. I love that. I told you before recording that my son very rarely gets so excited about a person that I'm talking to. And when I expressed to you that, like, I was reading this book to him tonight at our dining room table, and I said, Jonah, buddy, you know who this guy is. I read him, the author and illustrator, and I said, you know John Rocco, because I said he did that book you love from last year, Blizzard. And he just lit up. And to know, you know, you expressed about how special it is that you make these books by yourself, and then they go out and be loved by all of these children. But I feel honored to be able to bring to you that story that my kid's one of those children. And you're doing that in his life. And in that way, you're affecting me in such a special and different way than a lot of other people that come on this show do. I love picture books. And I love talking about them. But man, when my kid connects with them, that's a different level there. And that's a really special thing. So just, you know, for you and the stories that come to you and the career that you have and that you will continue to have, John, I'm really grateful that you're there, and that my kid is one of those kids that you're reaching. I'm thankful to you for that.
Oh, geez, Matthew, you're gonna make me cry. That's not what this podcast is.
Welcome to the crying podcast.
and as I said to you, I understand that, because I've had that experience with my own daughter.
Yes.
And just, you know, reading books and then being able to introduce her to the person that made those books and seeing, you know, how she lights up. And it's just so much fun to be in this world. It's a great place to be. Yeah. I'm really grateful. I've been in part of this world for 10 years now, and I've met so many amazing people and some of my best friends who do this for a living. And I think that I will continue to do it until I can no longer lift a pencil.
Mm. Well, with our mind on those children and their faces and the joy they get from reading these books, I'm going to ask you this final question and give you a chance to share a message to them. So, John, I'll see a library full of children tomorrow morning. Is there a message that I can bring to them from you?
My first instinct was, well, don't pick your nose and wipe it in the book.
No, come
on. The pages stick together. It just really... you know... It was hard to think about that question, because, you know, I go and speak to kids all the time at schools and libraries, and you get to do it on a daily basis, so you're much more familiar than I. But part of what I try to say to kids is, if you like to write and you like to draw, know that even the best of us, We fail miserably every day. meaning, when I start a drawing, it's really, really bad. When I write my first sentence, it's really, really, really bad. The only difference from me and someone who quits after doing something really bad is that I'll do it again. And the thing that I learned is, if I draw something again it gets a little bit better. And if I draw it again, it gets better than that. And then it keeps getting better every time I draw it. So I approach that every time knowing when I first put pencil to paper, my first drawing is just going to be terrible. And that's okay, because you have to get it down. Same thing with writing. My first sentence, or when I start writing a book, it's terrible. But I'll do it again, and it'll get better. And I always know that. And so that's something that I always keep in the back of my mind is, okay, this first drawing or this first sentence is going to be bad. But if I get it down, and then I can do it again, and it'll be better. And so that's what I try to impart to most of the kids that I talk to, because I know so many who just give up if they can't, you know, do what's exactly in their mind the first time out the gate. And that's the biggest shame, you know. It would be sad to give up something like that if you enjoy doing it. So that's what I would say to your kids tomorrow.
The podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 350 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. And Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with the books they'll love. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect any ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Up on the podcast, Victoria Jamieson shares All's Fair in Middle School, her newest graphic novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.